Exploring the debate between science and religion. This is Seeking Truth, Science, Mystery and Human Identity from St. Paul's Cathedral.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce our panel. Starting at my far right is Alistair McGrath, a professor of theology at King's College London, a former atheist. His background is in chemistry and molecular biophysics and the interaction of Christian theology and the natural sciences has been a major theme in his work. Sitting next to him, immediately on my right, is Steve Jones, Professor of Genetics at London College, University College London. Steve is a current atheist. He's one of the great communicators of science in this generation and is a prolific author and broadcaster both on radio and television, with series including giving the Reef lectures on the language of the genes and a six-part TV series on human genetics called In the Blood. Diana Lipton, on my left, is lecturer in Hebrew Bible and Jewish Studies at King's College London, where she teaches Hebrew texts and Jewish thought and practice. A former investment banker, she got out just in time. She has a book just published called Longing for Egypt. And on the far left of the dais here is Simon Conway Morris, Professor of Evolutionary Paleobiology in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Cambridge. Simon is a Christian and another of the great communicators of science, and he gave the University of Edinburgh's prestigious Gifford Lectures last year, calling the series Darwin's Compass, How Evolution Discovers the Song of Creation. Would you please welcome our panel? Steve, perhaps we can begin with you, and we're going to start with just some introductory questions from which each member of the panel will give an answer. Steve, could you explain to us what evolution is?
Evolution is overwhelmingly something which is simple. Darwin defined it in three words: descent with modification. Descent, the passage of information from one generation to the next. Modification, the fact that that passage is imperfect. And under those circumstances, evolution is inevitable. It is bound to happen. It is so simple, in fact, it could almost be physics. Darwin had, evolution, though, is more than just the accumulation of error. Darwin had what's been described as the best idea any scientist has ever had, which is the notion of natural selection. That too is simple. Natural selection is inherited differences in the ability to reproduce. If you carry a gene that makes it more likely that you'll stay alive and find a mate, that gene will become more common in the next generation, and over the generations, genes will build up and new forms of life will emerge. Many people have drawn parallels between the evolution of life and the evolution of language. And I think that's, to some degree, fair. I often think that evolution is actually the grammar of biology. You can't understand a language, you can't learn a language, unless you understand the way it's put together. When we speak English, of course, that's just implicit. We understand without really understanding that we understand the language, the grammar of the English language. When you learn French, you have to understand the grammar. I think it was Diderot who said that English is only French badly pronounced. And by saying that, actually, he was making an evolutionary statement. It's clearly the case that English and French were once almost the same language, but they have diverged from each other through descent with modification. Evolution is the language of biology. Without evolution, you cannot be a biologist. You can study some narrow aspect of it, but if you don't believe in evolution, and I say this to medical students, many of whom don't believe in the science, I say it's like being a chemist in the sense of somebody who sells pills, rather than a pharmacologist, somebody who designs drugs. Anybody can sell pills over the counter, but if they don't understand how they work, they're missing the joy of their own science. Anyone can deny the truth of evolution, but by doing that, they're missing the joy of understanding the living world. Darwin was the first to point that out, and I can't think of a single biologist in the world who disagrees with me.
Thank you, Steve. Can I just say, on a practical note, I've had a message to say that if you're sitting under the dome and still can't hear, they can hear splendidly in the nave. So do please move, and we won't think you're walking out in disapproval. Can I come on to Alistair now? Alistair, some Christians have a problem with evolution. Why do you think that is? And what is creationism, which is one of the ways of dealing with it?
Well, there's no doubt that when Darwin published The Origin of Species, this raised some questions for Christians. And I think it's good just to focus on two very briefly. One of them is the interpretation of the book of Genesis. And for historical reasons, British Christians, especially British Protestant Christians, had interpreted Genesis in a predominantly literal way. In other words, seeing it as a historical account of what actually happened. And Darwin's account of creation seemed to be in conflict with what Genesis said. So clearly this sparked off a debate on how that book was to be interpreted at the time. A second challenge, which I want to focus on, is the big questions raised about the status of human nature. For Christians, as indeed for many other people, humanity is God's last word, so to speak. In other words, that humanity stands at the height of God's creation. And in The Origin of Species, Darwin hints at this. And in The Descent of Man, he states this much more explicitly, that actually humanity is a late arrival on the scene and arrived on the scene by the same biological processes which gave rise to everything else. In other words, there was a very big challenge being posed to the idea of the uniqueness of humanity, and above all the idea it had some special place in the created order. So clearly that generated some discussion. Now, of course, those discussions continue, and in the 20th and early 21st century, the movement known as creationism has begun to become quite significant. Creationism is defined in various ways, but the simplest way of understanding it is as a literal interpretation of the Genesis narrative to mean that humanity and everything else was brought into existence by God in a period of something like 6 days, each of 24 hours, about 6,000 years ago. It's a very interesting position. Historically, Christianity has taken a number of positions on how Genesis should be interpreted, and this is one of them, but it's not the only one. And again, interestingly, creationism flared up very briefly in the aftermath of Darwin's publications, and then died away. It resurged in North America during the 1920s, during the fundamentalist controversies, and then again it died away. After the Second World War, it just really seemed to have fizzled out. And then in the 1980s, it really began to resurge once more. And certainly the historical question that's really interesting to explore is, why has creationism made such a big comeback? So to summarize very briefly, what Darwin is saying is challenging, raising very deep questions that it's important to talk about. For me, he doesn't pose fundamental difficulties, for example, to the authority of the Bible, or indeed to what Christians believe. These can all be woven together. And that's why it's interesting historically to go back to the time of Darwin himself and to note that actually church people responded much more positively to what Darwin was saying than you might begin to think from reading some recent popular books on the subject.
Thank you very much indeed. You touched on the biblical texts, and Diana, it's those that we have, if you like, borrowed and inherited from the tradition in which you stand. How should we interpret the creation narratives in Genesis from your point of view?
Well, first of all, you should interpret them cautiously and with great humility. We're dealing with an ancient text with a worldview which in some ways is very similar to ours, but in other ways extraordinarily different, and it's sometimes difficult to know where are the parallels, where are the differences. And of course, it's also in Hebrew, and anything we read that isn't in Hebrew is a translation, an interpretation, and that has to be taken on board also. There are many ways, therefore, to read the Hebrew Bible creation narratives, and there are many ways that I could offer tonight, but I'm going to assume that I was invited here primarily as a biblical scholar and say something about it from my point of view as a biblical scholar. I'm assuming, as many biblical scholars do, that the creation, certainly the first creation narrative in Genesis, emerged in the 6th or 5th century BCE, probably 6th century, when the authors came into contact in the Babylonian exile for the first time with Babylonian creator gods, instead of with Canaanites. Nature gods, the ones that they were more at that point familiar with. They also came into contact with something closer to what we would imagine describe as science, people interested in calendars and astronomy in the way that ancient Israelites were not at the time. So what I want to focus on is really with that in mind, and I want to ask the question whether the biblical creation account, especially Genesis 1, bearing all of that in mind, is compatible with evolution. So I think there are two ways of thinking about what Genesis 1 especially achieves, and they both have to do with organization. The first one, the more familiar one to us, is that Genesis 1 speaks about the organization of the material world, the organization of space. So we hear in Genesis 1 about how land is divided from water, how the sky is divided from the sea, how animals and plants are divided up by species according to their kind, and all of these things must be then kept in place. And in many ways, the perfect organism for doing that is the human being, who then will in some ways tidy it all up and keep it organized as it was created. But in addition to that, we can read Genesis 1, the creation narrative, as dealing with the organization of time. And I think that's where the Babylonian background is extremely important, because the idea of chaotic, uncreated time was something of particular interest to the Babylonians. So there we have the day and night being created, the sun and the moon, the weeks, the months, the seasons, and all of this done in 7-day units. We hardly remember what was created on each day, but we do remember that creation took 7 days. So we have the organization of space, which doesn't necessarily involve much change. It could be a bit like cleaning up your house. You can more or less every day get it back where it was. Nothing much has to change. But then we have the organization of time. And once these two things come together, we have change on a much greater scale than we could imagine if we're just dealing with the organization of space. There, I think, the equation, the conjunction of space and time coming together means that not only is it possible to read these narratives as being compatible with ideas of evolution, but it's almost impossible to imagine that the authors of Genesis 1, although I don't think for a moment they had evolution in mind, did not have a worldview which is consistent in some ways with ours when we're thinking about change in those respects.
Thank you, Diana. And finally, to Simon. The creation story gives humanity a divinely ordained place in creation. Could this actually square with the scientific understanding of evolution, so that in fact they're not incompatible?
Well, thank you very much, Martin. I hope, first of all, I am at least audible. Whether I'll be understood is a slightly different point. The first point to make is that religion certainly needs evolution, and the reason for that is because, of course, it's a fundamental truth of the universe, and that's something religions can never ignore. Actually, the other day I was rereading cover to cover The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, and I was very struck in that book how much it's haunted by the ghost of William Paley, the person who stumbled across the watch on the heath. And of course, Darwin's attempt is wholly successful. He destroys this argument comprehensively and irrevocably. But I think it's also the case, and this may be a little bit more surprising, that I believe that evolution itself actually is necessary not only for religion, but also that religion requires evolution. They are mutually supporting each other. And I'll try and briefly explain why that might be. Effectively, a large part of the evolutionary synthesis insists that it is more or less random. That's, of course, most familiar perhaps from mutations, but also such things as giant rocks falling out of the sky, volcanoes blowing their heads off, and general mayhem ensuing, which suggests that so dramatic are these catastrophes that there's no predictability in the whole process of evolution. Well, that's rather strange, because all other sciences I know about are predictable. And I think, in fact, there are now some strong arguments to suggest that, like other sciences, evolution is also much more predictable than is sometimes thought to be the case. And effectively, and I have to say this is an argument I've been pursuing not alone, but it's one which is deeply unpopular in some circles, I'm very struck by the fact that there are a remarkably limited number of solutions to which life can actually navigate. I could give you examples from viruses all the way through from fungi through to even ourselves in terms of the human condition. Again and again, we find that actually the options available for evolution are far more restricted than we might actually expect. And oddly enough, this applies most interestingly of all to the phenomena of intelligence. This is something which, famously like the camera eye of the octopus and the camera eye of the human, is referred to as convergent. So too, we have now very good evidence that this is a convergent phenomena which has evolved more than once. So it's evolved in our immediate ancestors, the great apes, but also independently has in the octopus and, for instance, some birds. Then one suspects that perhaps in a funny sort of way, we are predictable. Now, why does all this matter? I think it matters for a number of reasons. To begin with, we can start to look at evolution more like a search engine. It has a way of discovering things which, if you like, have the potentiality from the beginning of creation. That's perfectly orthodox Christianity, so far as I'm aware. But more importantly, and again, this might be something we can pick up in the conversations, both with you and between ourselves, is it seems to me, frankly, that we have no proper explanation for the nature of mind or the nature of consciousness. And this, I must stress beyond all misapprehensions, is not a gaps argument. It's not the finger of God coming in to do something specific. It is merely that we have not asked the right question in the right place in the appropriate context. Nor, by the way, and this is again familiar with Christian theology, do we have any explanation, I think, in a scientific context for the existence of what theologians refer to as radical evil. And if you don't believe in radical evil, I suggest you go to your public library tomorrow and go to history. Any section will confirm that. So what does all this mean? Well, I think effectively, oddly enough, evolution at the moment is very analogous to 19th century physics. 19th century physicists thought they had it all sorted out. There was no remaining doubt. They effectively assumed that this was the end of the story. It seems to me that, in fact, that is the absolute reverse, and I think this will prove very much to be the case in evolution. I suspect very strongly indeed that just as quantum mechanics completely overthrew physics, I strongly suspect that evolution in its own way is, dare I say, awaiting its second Einstein. Darwin's mechanism is entirely unexceptional, but quite frankly, it is as interesting now as ionic bonding is to a chemist. So I humbly suggest that we are very much on the first steps of our understanding. And that, by the way, is why I'm a scientist. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. Well, I wonder whether perhaps we might begin our panel discussion. But first, can I just remind you, if you have questions that you would like to ask, please write them down on your papers and wave them in the air so that the wandsman can see that you wish to ask a question. They will be collected and brought to us here on the dais. But Steve, can I perhaps give you an opportunity to respond to some of what you've heard from the other panellists, each of whom has a faith, both either Jewish or Christian?
Yeah, I find that the arguments between science and religion are a bit like they're a battle. But they're a battle between two very different creatures. They're rather like a battle between a shark and a tiger. On their own territory, each of those beasts is a very fearsome opponent. But if you have a tiger in the sea, or even worse, a shark on land, they're bound to lose. And an awful lot of the discussion between evolutionists and believers in various faiths, I think, just got talked past each other. And it's interesting to me that we in the field of evolutionary biology, in my experience, and I've been to many, many dozens of extraordinarily boring scientific conferences, we never ever talk about the overlap between evolutionary biology and religious faith, because we don't see an overlap. I don't expect somebody who goes to a conference on the chemistry of chlorine to ask, what would the book of Genesis made of this? And I think the same is true of evolutionary biology. In the end, it's just another science. It's just another way of understanding the world around us. The book of Genesis, actually, if you examine it, is very much a textbook. I often think of it as the first human genetics textbook of all. It asks very sensible questions, and it comes up for its day with remarkably sensible answers. How did we all begin? What's the nature and origin of sex? Are we born with a predestined fate, good or evil? To what tribe do we belong? Who's related to whom? What do we, and if we go all the way to the end, to the book of Revelations, what will happen in the future? All these are really rather scientific questions. And they're questions which have been asked by many, many faiths, and they're very sensible questions to be asked. When I start my introductory evolutionary lectures, I start by, perhaps I shouldn't, I'm told I shouldn't do this, but I have a very beautiful painting of the Garden of Eden, and I say what a beautiful image this is of human origins, and everybody's of course familiar with it. Then I show them a rather fearsome devil, picture of a fearsome devil, and this fearsome devil is the central protagonist of the Chinese origin tale. His name was Pan Gu. And Pan Gu, it was said in ancient China, was a giant god who hatched from an egg that floated in the cosmic void, appeared on Earth, grew rapidly for 17,000 years until his head hit the sky, which was a solid blue firmament. His head then exploded and he died. His eyes became the sun and the moon. His tears became the rivers of the earth. And the lice and the fleas on his body became men and women, respectively. And I say, well, that too is a creation myth, and it's not as beautiful as the biblical one, but it was probably in its day believed by almost as many people. How can you separate them? What evidence can you offer for one versus the other? And the answer is, you cannot. You have only faith. Then I show them a picture of the title page of The Origin of Species, and I say, here's another creation myth, if you call it, and here's the evidence which supports it. And in my view, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming, and I'm astonished that people should deny it. I've often faced now at UCL, which is, as you know, frequently described as the godless college of Gower Street, specifically founded in order to put paid to the religious tests for Oxford and Cambridge, and then our corns were then stamped on by our friends at King's College, who were founded in opposition to us, and not much has changed. But I'm often asked by creationist students at UCL about evolution, and I say, look, if you insist on believing in creationism, in my view, and I'm not at all religious, you're doing far more harm to your religion than you are to my science. Place yourself in the position of an intelligent Islamic young boy or girl, or Christian, from an Islamic family or a Christian family, who's told with complete certainty at the age of 8 or 9 by his pastor or imam, who he greatly admires and listens to, he's told that humans and dinosaurs emerged on Earth by mystical means 6,000 years ago and lived together. And he believes this. Then he or she goes on to do, let's say, A-level biology, and it becomes completely crystal clear that that's babbling nonsense. What does he or she then think? Why should he or she believe anything else their pastors have been telling them? If they've been lying about that, why aren't they lying about the rest of it? And that, to me, is where the interaction comes. I mean, we're both seeking truth in our own way, but I think they're a different kind of truth. And the attempt to make them the same kind of truth, I think, is by its definition, is doomed.
Thank you, Steve. I'm going to ask Simon if he might like to respond to that. And perhaps, Simon, you might want to say something about where the overlap is, which seems to me to be a very, very helpful observation.
Well, it's impossible to disagree with almost anything Steve says, except everything. In as much as what we're talking about are entire world pictures about the way we see the universe around us. And I think possibly one way to try to begin to tease this apart, and I'm certainly not imagining that Steve himself would subscribe to these views, I rather doubt it in fact, is the general sort of view that sort of Darwin becomes the encoding myth of our time. And that, I think Mary Midgley, amongst others, would regard as completely bogus. So there's no doubt at all about the realities around us. There's no doubt at all about the scientific explanations. The question which really matters to begin with is, what is the world constructed, and why is it constructed in such a way, and why to us does it have such things as meaning and purpose? And these are metaphysical questions, they're not scientific questions. But again and again we see effectively a variety of scientific argument where the entire explanation is universally hijacked in support of something which is solely reliant on scientific data. Maybe two other very quick comments. The first is, again, this may not ring with all ears in St. Paul's, but all of us live by myth. Myth, be it the Genesis narratives, which I think are our foundational myth, are things which resonate with us at a level far deeper than the speculations which were carried out in Down House. They're very important, but they're not the end of the story. Another aspect which I think is sometimes misunderstood by people who are not of faith, I'm not in any way accusing them of anything, that's not my intention, is that I can assure you, and perhaps Alistair and Diana will perhaps confirm that, the enterprise we're engaged on is extremely risky. All of us know that science may yet produce certain irrefutable facts which irrefutably destroy our world picture. But from what I understand about the cosmology of the Big Bang, what I understand about the nature of the nervous system, what I understand about evolution, I, for the time being, and I don't mind taking a risk, I've often been wrong in the past, but I rather suspect, as I mentioned in my introductory remarks, we are very much dealing with unfinished business.
Thank you. Diana, we have here a balance between the risk of scientific inquiry and our myths and texts, and which Steve has already described as having a certain beauty to them. Would you like to comment on that response from Simon?
I agree with what Simon said, that, and also with what Steve said. There's a rabbinic story about that. They're both right. In that, I also see the Genesis creation stories as an attempt by people in the ancient world to answer their own questions about their origins and about the world around them, many of which are similar to our questions. We haven't answered them to our satisfaction. As I indicated, I see the particular text that we have, especially Genesis 1, as having a context, a Babylonian context, a context which for its authors was exile. And it seems to me, and this is where I would suggest that in some ways these biblical texts have almost anticipated some of the possible changes, the uncertainty that Simon alluded to, in that it seems to me that part of what motivated the authors of Genesis 1 to write what they did is precisely encountering worlds they could not have anticipated, changes that they didn't know how to accommodate. And so in describing the world the way they did, first of all, they were trying to create security, order, certainty where they found none. But secondly, I think they did it in such a way that they projected into future times the changes and the uncertainty that they themselves had encountered. So they didn't offer a version of creation which ties everything up, in which there's no future movement or change or development, but rather they combine an attempt to reassure themselves with an awareness that things could change again.
Thank you. Alistair, I wonder whether you might pick up on this business of risk and inquiry, because I think what Diana has said about the impact of Babylonian exile on seeing God, creation, differently, may give us some indication as to how we read the scriptures, where they come from, and perhaps challenge something of the fundamentalist reading of them that you described, that Darwin was such a challenge for.
Well, I think that's a very important point to make. And certainly, if we look at the history of how Christians interpret the Bible, we see many possible interpretations being debated. And we need to get away from the idea that there was somehow some absolutely fixed Christian interpretation of Genesis, which somehow more recent Christians have abandoned or perverted to try and bring Darwin into the picture. I think the key point to make is that every text needs to be interpreted. And there were at least three major lines of interpretation of Genesis there, even by the 5th century. One of them was due to Augustine. Let me tell you what Augustine said. Augustine said that God brought the world into being in an instant, that space and time are part of the created order, and that God made the world in such a way that it had the potential to develop and to evolve. Now you can see immediately that that is one way of reading Genesis, which is going to move us in some very interesting directions. There's a real need for us to recalibrate how we read Scripture, realizing that in the past perhaps some Christians have got things wrong, some things right. And part of our continual duty as Christians is to keep interrogating the text, asking, what does this really mean? Or, to take up a phrase from the New Testament, from 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, put everything to the test and hold on to what is good. And certainly, if we think, for example, of Charles Kingsley, a name known to some of you, he wrote The Water Babes, Westward Ho. He was also canon of Westminster Abbey. And in 1871, commenting on Darwin, he said this: "We knew of old that God made all things. Now we know he did even more than that. He made all things make themselves." And Kingsley saw this as an extension, an expansion of traditional Christian thinking, not its contradiction. So the key point is, this is about the interaction, the dialogue, in which Christians can actually begin to challenge traditional interpretations, but also realizing that there's gold in those hills, that some of those we have to set to one side, but others speak to us powerfully, and the capacity to illuminate. And I think the challenge is to reach into our past and reappropriate those that make more sense today.
Thank you, Alistair. Well, I think from Charles Kingsley we get permission to read the scriptural texts in a very much more open way than perhaps some from a fundamentalist point of view have done. Steve, I wonder whether you might like to take us forward now to ask what implications that sort of reading might have for the difference between human beings and other creatures, something that is clearly important in the Christian tradition.
Yes, I think it's an interesting question. Actually, there's a quotation from Charles Kingsley, which isn't perhaps a very familiar one. I probably haven't got it quite right. But Kingsley, who was a Darwinist, and of course the Water Babies is in many ways a Darwinian parable. Charles Darwin appears in the Water Babies as Professor put them all in spirits, except you have to miss out the vowels. If you haven't read the Water Babies, or if you haven't read it since you were a child, read it again. It is one of the most terrifying pieces of intellectual pornography I've ever come across. It's quite astounding. Charles Kingsley had a strong tie with Ireland, And he went to Ireland in about 1865, and he wrote to his wife, I'm here in Ireland, and I see all around me human chimpanzees. It would not be so bad if they were black, but heavens above, they are white, and I cannot stand it. And that really is a classic misinterpretation of what evolution can tell you about what it means to be human. It has a mirror image. I mean, it's a disgusting thing in our 21st century eyes to say, but in the 19th century, in the 20th century, early 20th century, it was common to draw evolutionary parallels or evolutionary analogues for the levels of the various races, human races. Francis Galton, who was Darwin's cousin, was very strong on that. There's a modern analogy of it, which again I think takes me back to my strong feeling that these are two different fields, which is, it has various names, but one of its names is the Great Ape Project. Now, as many of you will know, there is quite a remarkable sharing of the amount of DNA between ourselves and chimpanzees. There's arguments about the figures. The standard figure is about 98.8% sharing. The most recent stuff, a few months old, puts that down to about 95%. And there's been a strong move, and the Spanish government, for example, has passed a law which prevents experimentation, animal experimentation upon chimpanzees, on the grounds that they are 98% human, and therefore they deserve some version of human rights. Now, the argument about animal experimentation is a separate one, but it seems to me a downright blasphemous statement that they are 98% human with 98% of our rights. They're not human at all. We aren't 98% chimpanzee. It's worth remembering that we share about 50% of our DNA with a banana. And we're not 50% banana, either above or below the waist, right? So it seems to me a fundamental misunderstanding of the question. What makes us... Many people in the 19th century felt that what frightened them about evolution was it knocked them off their pinnacle of being special. Queen Victoria in 1842 went to London Zoo, and she saw the orangutan, whose name was Jenny, and she wrote in her diary, and I think I've got it right, that I saw the orangutan, she is frightfully and painfully and awfully human. Painfully and awfully human. And Queen Victoria put her finger on what scared the Victorians, which was, my goodness, we're just animals. Now, to me, as an evolutionary biologist, the more I learn about evolution, the more unique I feel as a human being. Because everything that makes us human rather than shaved monkeys, Darwinian man, though well-behaved, is really what a monkey shaved, to quote Gilbert and Sullivan, is unique to humans. Our sense of the past, our willingness to consider the future, drive to help people who aren't our close relatives, the fact that men don't go out and rape. And the biology is straightforward. Rapists, male rapists have more children than male non-rapists. We don't do it. All these things are unique to ourselves. And evolution is no good at understanding the unique because it's a comparative science. I'll shut up in a second, but I will tell you a short joke which my father told me. He didn't realize that he was talking about this problem. I've talked about the parallel between evolution and language. I was brought up in West Wales in Aberystwyth, which in my youth was a Welsh-speaking town, and still is as long as there are English people in the room. And the story goes that a local went into Aberystwyth's only Chinese restaurant, was given a very good Chinese meal, served by a clearly Chinese waiter who spoke perfect Welsh. And the local was amazed, so he beckoned over the owner, and he said, "Well, boy, where do you get this amazing fellow? A Chinaman who can speak Welsh." The owner looked alarmed and said, "Keep your voice down. He thinks he's learned English." And that actually illustrates my point. From a Chinese speaker's point of view, Welsh and English are dialects of the same language, which of course they are, language of Indo-European. We can only understand languages because there are many which we can compare with each other. If there was only one world language, let's say English, we wouldn't understand where it came from. We couldn't say how old it was, whether it evolved or been created. We wouldn't know. It would be unique. And the same is true for everything that makes us human and not ape or not banana. It's unique, and evolution has very little to do with it.
Thank you. I don't know what that says about banana-eating Spaniards. It's an interesting thing to reflect on, isn't it? Simon, I wonder whether you might like to respond to that.
Well, I almost feel Welsh. Conway Morris, think on. Very fair points, of course, and wonderfully told. I think one of the ironies with Darwinism is that so much of our commonality with the rest of life has somehow been ignored and lost, and in fact, in many ways, one would have thought this makes us more part of the biosphere rather than somehow being separate. But I think, as Steve alluded, there is a small problem in my reading over the last few years. What's fascinated me, and I think anybody would more or less agree with this, is how paper thin the differences are between ourselves and all other animals, and indeed the 50% of the banana which we so proudly share our heritage. So what exactly is the difference? Well, you can see a theological monster emerging straight away. So once again, I have to insist I'm not dealing with gaps arguments. But as I think Steve mentioned in passing, there's a question of altruism or lack of altruism. Helping people you've never met before, not raping people you have no affinity for. Those sorts of things we regard both as highly desirable or disastrously evil. Correspondingly, language. It is vocalizations in animals, yes, tweet, chirp, grunt, but no grammar. So how might we approach this? Well, I think there are two very interesting theological possibilities about this. One is, and this is something, again, which I'm afraid Darwinism is not well equipped to deal with, is that there are, and theologically this is a familiar argument, there are other realities. And so the altruism we might see very vaguely reflected in some groups of animals, when it becomes fully fledged, is not an emergence per se, but as I mentioned in my introductory remarks, it's more of a discovery. Similarly, language, perhaps some of you who are familiar with the work of Owen Barfield have entrancing ideas about the nature of poetry in particular, and thereby myth, rather than simply a series of formalized grunts. But we can take this argument in the other direction as well, because I feel extremely seriously that with regard to our evolutionary ancestry, which is stamped through us, the history in our bones, as we say, that means that there is a fascinating set of links, and not least, of course, people are concerned about vivisection, rightly so, it is an ethical problem. Should we experiment on chimps? Should we experiment on bananas? Well, you know, there's some degree of uncertainty between one and the other. But at least so far as many animals go, and I myself would include insects, next time you swat that fly, is it conscious? Thank you.
Thank you. I think one of the things that we might well want to pursue here and has been around and about in the background is the question of intelligent design. And I'm going to ask Alistair if you might like to comment on that, and then perhaps come to you, Diana, to talk about how that might feature from your perspective as well. But Alistair, to begin.
Well, the phrase intelligent design refers to a way of thinking about the biological process and indeed the arrival of humanity on this planet, which argues that humanity and indeed many other aspects of the biological order are so complex that they could not be accounted for by purely natural explanations. And therefore, the movement called intelligent design, which is based in North America, especially at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington, argues that in some way the complexity of the natural order is such that one has to posit an intelligent designer to account for what you see. Now, I'm going to be critical of this movement in a moment, but I want to say, A, that it does actually make some good points, even though it takes them in some unhelpful directions. And secondly, that actually I could use the phrase intelligent design quite happily, but I would mean something different by it. The Bible of this movement is a book by Michael Behe, published about 15 years ago, called Darwin's Black Box, a rather nice, catchy title. And his argument is that there are many features of the biological world which have what he calls irreducible complexity. He gives examples. How is the blood able to clot? It's just so complex, you can't really account for that on purely naturalist processes. Now, here will be my concerns about intelligent design. First, Simon used the phrase the God of the gaps a few moments ago, and we might like to come back to that. God of the gaps basically means an approach which says science is unable to explain certain things, therefore let us locate God in these explanatory gaps. The real problem with that is that as the gaps contract, God gets squeezed out. And I really don't approve of this approach at all. It seems to me to be very seriously misguided. And I'm afraid intelligent design, or idea as its proponents call it, seems to me to fall into that category. It seems to me a much more helpful approach is to stand back and not look at those things which cannot be explained, but rather ask, why can we make sense of things at all? Albert Einstein's famous phrase of 1936, the eternal mystery of the world is its intelligibility. And people like myself or John Polkinghorne or Richard Swinburne would say the really interesting thing is, why can the human mind make so much sense of what we observe? So for me, that's a completely different way of looking at things. And again, it just seems to me intelligent design instinctively realizes there is something that needs added levels of explanation, but I don't think the approach they give is either necessary or appropriate, and in my view, there are much more helpful Christian ways of beginning to engage with the evidence they bring forward.
Thank you. Could we just stay with that for a moment? And would you perhaps give us an indication of what the headlines might be of the more helpful Christian ways forward before we go to look at how it might be seen from a Jewish perspective?
The more helpful headline from a Christian perspective would be God creates a world which is meant to develop, and God continues to in some way be involved in that development. In other words, it's about a God who in some way meant this thing to happen, and obviously we'd want to have a discussion about exactly how this guidance takes place. But I would want to say that actually one can begin to construct a theology of evolution which recognizes it is happening, but also is saying that in some way this is leading us to intended outcomes.
Thank you. Diana, would you like to come back on that from the perspective of your particular tradition?
Well, first of all, I think, as I've already suggested, the idea of development being built into creation is something that I think is very strongly present in Genesis 1 and 2, but especially in Genesis 1, and I think that is compatible with a Jewish way of reading the text, as well as with a Christian way. But I would say, what I would emphasize, in addition to what Alistair said, is that development and change will bring in their train difficulties. So even as God created, according to Genesis 1, the world in the way he wanted it to be, he anticipated, according to the narrative of Genesis 1, that it wouldn't remain that way. And I think what then emerges is the question of what will fix the problems, what mechanisms are offered within Genesis 1, within the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament creation narratives, to deal with the negative consequences of change and development. And here I think there is quite an interesting difference between the Christian view, as I would understand it, and the Jewish one. So it seems to me that the Christian view of creation, as I understand it, much more emphasizes what I began by characterizing as the organization of the material world, or as the organization of space. And therefore, as I indicated, it's not surprising that on many Christian accounts that I'm familiar with, the pinnacle of creation is man, because man will be responsible for maintaining, for stewarding, as the Christian term is, for stewarding the order of the world in future, for keeping it the way God, according to the creation narrative, intended to be. The very different emphasis, I think, in Jewish readings of these texts is to focus not so much on the material world, and maybe that's not so surprising if these texts originated in a context of exile where their authors had little control over their material, physical context, but rather emphasized the organization of time in the way that I mentioned at the beginning. And there I think we see something very different. It's not man that is the pinnacle of creation on the sixth day, and man therefore responsible for maintaining divine order, but rather the pinnacle of creation is Shabbat, the Sabbath. It is a temporal unit which in its position at the end of the six-day created world, the created order, will maintain that kind of order if observed into in future times and at times when things go wrong. And the kind of ironic part of this is that whereas on the first model of creation as ordering the physical world, as ordering space, man must be in some ways interventionist to return the world to God's order or to keep it in God's order. On the second model, where the Sabbath, where the observance of the Sabbath is actually a ceasing of activity, it's a withdrawal in a sense from the world. It's a withdrawal into time without process, without activity, with no work. It's really man's withdrawal there that actually is the guarantor, is the fixing mechanism. And I think that's an interesting contrast between those two understandings, as I would understand them.
Thank you very much indeed. I hope we can come back to that, and I want to hold that for a time, because it seems to me that it resonates very powerfully with the statement by Jesus that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And perhaps we might just tuck that away at the back of our minds to come back to Alistair. I may come back to you on that in terms of what that might mean about relationship to creation and something we haven't yet raised, which is the Christian understanding of the Trinity involved in the creation. But Steve, can we come back to you and ask whether all of this discussion that we've been having so far amounts to us being able to say that the atheism that has challenged some of the Christian tradition, the traditions of faith, is that A, rational, and B, moral?
Speaking as an atheist in St. Paul, I should probably take the Fifth Amendment here. I mean, once again, I would go back to what I said. Darwin became an atheist, because I'm sure everybody here knows, because he couldn't believe there was a God, given the cruelty that he saw in the world, particularly the death of his beloved daughter, Annie. I took no interest, but I am an atheist because I don't, rather like Leibniz, the mathematician. Whenever people use arguments that say, as we heard a moment ago, for example, that evolution was meant by God, that God put it all together so that it should happen, what Leibniz said is, I have no need of that hypothesis. That hypothesis adds nothing to my understanding of the way the world works, and I have no way of disproving that hypothesis. And science is a profession for pessimists. We're in the business of trying to disprove our enemies first, and with luck, our friends' hypotheses. And if we do disprove them, we feel very, very good. And the statement that somehow there is built in a designed end in view, either to accumulate in humans, in Homo sapiens, or any other creature, or in some special day, is just alien to the way we think. Actually, this argument was familiar to Darwin. Many people have heard of the French, great French biologist, Lamarck, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. Now, Darwin, it's often said that Darwin disliked Lamarck because he, Lamarck, believed in what's called the inheritance of acquired characters, the notion that, you know, the giraffe stretched its neck and to get the high leaves, and that stretched neck was then passed on to the next generation. Well, that wasn't true. Darwin himself believed that, and as I often say to my religiously very mixed a bunch of students, that experiment has been tried for the last 2,000 or more years since Jews and others started circumcising boys. It hasn't worked. They're still born with foreskins, okay? The real reason that Darwin disliked Lamarck, and he really did dislike him, was just this argument. Lamarck had a view which he called the law of necessary progress, that somehow, a bit like Samuel Smiles' Self-Help, a book incidentally published on the same day as The Origin of Species, somehow every day, in every way, everything was going to get better and better. Lamarck felt that we were all progressing towards being, if not perfect, at least being French. Okay? Darwin, again and again, writes both in The Origin and his notebooks. In his notebook somewhere he writes, never say higher nor lower. To Darwin, a tapeworm is just as much evolved as is a human being. Each one traces its ancestry to the identical ancestor in the distant past. Evolution has no direction of progress or of decay. There is no direction. It is entirely unpredictable. It arises from simple physical laws which at the moment we understand. Simon said that evolution is incomplete. Of course it's incomplete. Every science is incomplete. If a science was complete, it wouldn't be a science. It's only theology which can define itself as being complete. And really, that's why I remain an atheist, because I am uncertain, I lack the certainty, and I somehow envy the certainty of people who are religious.
Alistair, there's a challenge. Theology is complete. Does that do you out of a job?
That's a very interesting view of theology. I mean, as I see it, when I stopped being a scientist and became a theologian, I was pursuing the same search for truth. And I think both scientifically and theologically, that quest continues. It is not ended. In fact, I would say it's unending. That in many ways, in theology, you keep coming back to these questions. You keep coming back to these texts. You're always checking them out. Have I really got the best way of understanding these? Have I really appreciated the depth that's there? And I would say theology is really this unending task of trying to understand things correctly and also appreciate their greater depth. So I would share Steve's concern about any science, any way of thinking, which draws a line and says, that's it. I think these things are ongoing, and that it's part of the discipleship of the mind to quest for these new depths and see where they take us.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to come now to our questions, and many of these will arise from what you've heard from the panel discussion, and I think take us further along the lines of that discussion. And one of the questions that we've got here, which I'm going to direct to Diana, is what is the intervention of God in creation? How would you respond to that question?
It's an excellent question, whoever asked. Thank you very much. I would say that there's more than one account in the Bible of creation and of God's role in the continuation of the created order. And so on one model, we might think of the book of Job towards the end, chapters 34, 38, which describe God responding to Job's request to understand divine justice by saying, where were you when the world was created? Where were you? Where were you when the morning stars are woken up in the morning and when it's time for animals to breed and so on? It's very much an account of creation where God has to stay in it day by day to make it happen. And if God didn't wake up the morning stars and didn't encourage animals to mate, nothing else would happen in the future. It seems to me that Genesis 1, which for us is a more influential account of creation in our own thinking, actually doesn't have such a strong role for God's continuing action in creation. That much more is put to nature itself. And I think Alistair, I can't remember whose view, maybe it was Augustine's or maybe suggesting the idea that God sets creation in motion and then it continues itself. And that's a very strong element in Genesis 1, that everything is created with, that trees have fruit and plants have seeds, and humans and animals are commanded to propagate, to be fruitful and multiply. So what happens in the future is very much moves into the ballpark of the order itself. So I would say, according to Genesis 1, I don't see a great role for God in God's continuing intervention in creation, except as a role model, as I indicated, through his own willingness to rest and withdraw from it on the seventh day, then in a sense that's what we're also being asked to do.
Thank you. Alistair, can I come back to you just very briefly on this to ask whether you've got a view? I mean, I think just bearing in mind what we said earlier, the point about Jesus as the Lord of the Sabbath and the intervention of God, which is Trinitarian and incarnational.
Well, I think Diane and I could have a very good discussion about this, which would be a long discussion. But I think one point that would be very helpful just to add to this discussion is that from the Christian perspective, the idea of incarnation does talk about a God who doesn't simply create, but also inhabits and transforms the created order. So clearly that takes us in another very interesting direction. But I think Dan and I would probably agree on another point, which is that in some way the imprint of God can be discerned in the work of creation. And therefore that gives a motivation for the study of nature, and indeed a motivation for the whole scientific enterprise. And, you know, the basic idea is that by studying the created order, that enhances your appreciation of God. And indeed, in this cathedral tonight, we might say, look at this building. It helps you appreciate Christopher Wren. Likewise, the creation.
Thank you. It's sometimes been said that this is a building for Christopher Wren in which God is a lodger. So we do kind of want to see beyond that, if we may. Thank you very much. Simon, the question for you, I think, how do you distinguish between myth and scientific theory?
Well, rather simply, I think. Scientific theories are refutable, and most scientific theories over the last 300 years have been abandoned for the very simple reason they become part of a more complex story. Myth, on the other hand, is effectively the foundational sense of who we are and why we are here. And of course, that can sound extremely airy-fairy, but you only have to scratch people very slightly, and you'll find that some of the myths they begin to subscribe to, if they don't take some care, may actually go in some extraordinarily unhealthy directions. And of course, that sounds fearfully judgmental, and I have to be very careful about that, naturally enough. But the reality is that the reality we see may not be, in any sense, the entire reality. And again, that sounds rather vague. And in Christianity in particular, a recurrent problem has been what we refer to as Gnosticism, which is a rather airy-fairy sort of, my soul is a cosmic flower, etc., etc. And, of course, a good deal of New Age thinking, which in many ways has virtues, because it is trying to re-identify itself with deeper realities, I have a feeling slips towards Gnosticism. So in its own quiet way, science is painfully limited. It's wonderful to do, and I think Steve and I would agree about many things, but one of them would be that as and when we stumble on something new, in the frisson, the excitement is overwhelming. And it's not just I'm the first person in the world to ever know this. It is that some part of the articulation of reality actually falls into a larger picture. But that is not myth. Myth is something which transcends all that we do.
Thank you. Well, that sense of things opening up in front of us, I think Steve brings us back to you. There's a question here which I think is probably intended for you, and it's simply, is evolution over?
Oh, my goodness.
Or if not, where will it lead?
Yes, I rather foolishly gave a lecture on this in UCL 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was really a jeu d'esprit. I mean, I didn't take it very seriously. It led the national newspaper of Brazil last week on the front page. I think we all know what evolution is, descent with modification. Perhaps I should say, is natural selection over? And I'm pretty sure that actually, in the developed world, and at least for the time being, it is. I often entertain my students when I'm starting out a lecture by saying, look to your person to your left and the person to your right. You may do that if you wish. And they look at each other blankly, rather as we are here, and I say, with some accuracy, I say, 2 out of every 3 of you will die for reasons connected to the genes you carry. Their faces then fall. But then I say, cheer up. Had I been speaking in Christopher Wren's time, 2 out of every 3 of you would be dead already. And then, of course, it's true. We tend to forget what an extraordinary time we're living in. Even in the 18th and the 17th century, 2/3 of British babies were dead before they were 21. So there were lots of differences. Some people died, some people survived. And that was due to cholera, to starvation, to violence, to cold. Many of those lives and deaths were affected by genes that we know that are certainly genes that give you resistance or susceptibility to cholera and the Black Death. So there's plenty of raw material or fuel for natural selection. Now, in England, the year before last, 98.8% of all babies born lived until they were 21. No differences, no fuel for natural selection. Okay, natural selection turns on differences. There's a second part to the natural selection exam. We've all passed the first paper by definition because we're all alive. Okay? The second paper is somewhat more challenging, and there's a wider range of marks, because you have to have children, find a mate and have children. And from evolution's point of view, I might as well be dead because I have no children. If you look across the world, certainly into history, you find, certainly for men, enormous differences in the number of children they used to have. Even today, Mohammed bin Laden, who was Osama's father, had 22 wives and 65 children. Osama himself, last time they were counted, had 5 wives and 16 children. Now, if somebody has 22 wives, there are 21 other rather gloomy men out there who are becoming cannons and pellets and that kind of stuff and not having any wives at all. The one who I dug out as being the most lascivious of all was a guy called Moulay Ismail the Cruel of Morocco. And he had 888 children. There was more than one Mrs. Moulay, the Ismail the Cruel, I can tell you. Hundreds of his fellow men had no children at all. Huge differences. That's gone away. Now we have 1, 2, 3, or 4 children, almost worldwide, outside Africa. So no differences there either. No fuel for natural selection. Evolution, for the time being, has stopped. If you're worried about what utopia is going to be like, you shouldn't be, because you're living in it now.
Make the most of it. In that case, I think, Alistair, the next question I'd like to direct to you, and that is, did the soul evolve, and if so, how?
I have no idea how to answer that question. partly because the word soul is so diffuse, it's very difficult to say. What I think I would say is this, that for me, I do not believe in a soul as a kind of elemental part of the human makeup. But rather, I would define the soul much more in terms of a human being's relationship to God. And I would pick up from Psalm 8, what is man that thou regardest him? And actually, it's a very powerful statement of a theology of the soul. We are who we are because we exist in relationship to God, who actually values us and sees us in a certain way. So I would certainly want to explore it in that way. But certainly we could begin to answer this by making the point that the earliest cave pictures we know are widely interpreted to suggest that there's some sort of spiritual interest on the part of primitive man. And I think that if we are bound by the scientific evidence, we can't really answer that question. But I would say that there seems to have been some sort of interest in what we might now call the transcendent or the quest for the divine right from the word go. And certainly you can see that in every historical culture we have. Augustine, who I mentioned earlier, would talk about almost like a spiritual homing instinct, that in some way there's something about us which makes us quest for something that's beyond us.
Thank you. Well, Diana, you took us back to the 6th century BCE, and I wonder whether, with that sort of dimension of Alistair's answer in mind, you might want to say something about the nature of morality in terms of how we've developed, and how that is characteristic in your tradition, the Jewish tradition, of what we've evolved into.
Gosh, that's a hard question to answer too. I think what I would say to build on what Alistair said, is that, and also to pursue this question that keeps coming back of the difference between us and animals, or at least some possible difference, is the question of being relational. And it seems to me that a difference in the biblical account, in the Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 accounts of the creation of people versus the creation of animals, is that although both are commanded to... although both are commanded to be fruitful and multiply, and therefore male and females must be intended to interact, a difference is that God says of people and not of animals, it's not good for man to be alone. And that, in the second creation account in Genesis 1, is the justification for the creation of woman. And I think that is a sort of basis, that idea that we as human beings are intended in some way to relate, not just to propagate, because it will be possible, as animals do, to propagate without that kind of togetherness or opposite of being alone, but that we are intended to be relational, both to other people and, I think, also, given that man is in God's image, that the intention there, as Alistair also indicated, is that we are intended to relate to God in a different way from animals. And I think that relational aspect and the idea of empathy, that presumably when God says it's not good for man to be alone, God is actually empathizing in some ways with people. And that I would see not as a particular change in morality, but as a basis, a biblical basis for morality. And that is very much context-driven, that an ideal is that we would be relational and empathic, and that our morality would emerge from that. A reality is that that can easily be threatened, that there are things which stop us from thinking about other people and stop us from being empathic and stop us from acting as it seems that this text would intend us to be. And so it's not so much that I think morality evolves, but that at different times, different levels of morality are possible.
Thank you very much indeed. And I'd like to push that a little further and extend this idea of relational, empathic identity into a Christian understanding, I think, of the sense that it is the whole creation that is redeemed by Jesus Christ, everything that God has made. And I wonder, Simon, whether you might pick up a question that we've had here. How far should the apparent suffering involved in the process of evolution count against the Christian assertion of the God of love?
Again, that's a huge question. Course, and I think I see my staff locking the doors at the back. We shall be leaving at 10 o'clock sharp. Thank you very much. That is, I think, if anything, the fault line between modern-day Darwinism and much of theology. And in many respects, it is impossible to answer. How can you? And of course, the Newman fly of Darwin is translated into Belson ultimately in some way. The whole thing is, in many senses, absolutely horrifying. There are many ways we can approach this. Steve mentioned in passing that Darwin was an atheist. Well, we can chew the cud on that. But I think also slightly echoing maybe to begin with what Diana was saying, I think one of the dangers is how one loses trust in these things. And if you think this is a new invention, then the few days around Easter in the New Testament will, I think, inform you about what the loss of trust can actually involve. It was catastrophic. But with respect to the nature of evil, I mentioned in passing, and again in my introductory remarks, the fashionable phrase radical evil. And indeed, it is the case, I think, that, and this has been argued by some other people, and indeed a forthcoming book by a colleague of mine, that it is not necessary to look to the foundational myths of Genesis. And it's very possible Diana would disagree with this. I'm not a Jewish theologian, let alone a theologian of any sort. But nevertheless, there is a deep-seated sense, and this is articulated for people in the 17th century by Milton, by our generations, by Tolkien, as it so happens, that there is a radical fracture through the world which, in the words of C.S. Lewis, is effectively an aboriginal disaster. I suspect, but of course I'm not here to preach to you, but I suspect, and Alistair would probably agree that far, that only through the incarnation, in fact through the Christian orthodoxy of the resurrection as it happens, but I'm not here to persuade you of those truths, but it seems to me that if those things are genuinely meaningless, the death of Darwin's daughter Annie, if these actually mean nothing, that, in my view, difficult to say in a safe utopian world that we are for the next few years if we're lucky, is far more terrible and far more catastrophic than the sense that, however twisted and perverted, how malign, how so often one gets a sense of personal intervention. Do you remember the way Jung spoke about the rise of the Nazis as if Wotan had reawakened? Maybe we don't subscribe to Jung, but nevertheless, that I feel is a powerful myth for something which pervades our world. And in that sort of sense, again, to emphasize what we've discussed briefly, there are of course elements of risk of this, but there is ultimately a future promise. And of course the atheists say, ah, yes, airy fairy stuff, here we go again, off to North Oxford. Possibly so. But if one considers what some of the alternatives are, this is not putting our heads in the sand. This is deciding what the foundation of the universe was, why it went wrong, and how in Christian orthodoxy, and I think also in Jewish orthodoxy, and indeed all monotheistic religions, will be looking towards a sense of completion.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, I think with that foundational issue clearly on the table and very brilliantly opened up for us, there are two rounds that I'm going to ask the panellists to do now. First of all, a quick answer to one final question from each of you before a moment for each of you just to sum up your comments and views from this this debate. First of all, the question: what do the panellists say about the debate over creationism being discussed in the classroom today? Steve.
Well, it's problematic. The difficulty is the creationists in the United States have a thing they call the wedge strategy. The wedge strategy, and as of course we all know, in the US and in many other countries, the Constitution forbids the teaching of religion in state schools. The wedge strategy is that this is wrong. Religion, Christian religion, should be taught in state schools. The thin end of the wedge is creationism. Now, in fact, I show pictures of the Garden of Eden in my lectures, and that you could say I'm teaching creationism, but I'm not. I'm very suspicious of this notion that we ought to have both views treated, even if not of equal weight. I sometimes say it's like me expecting me, when I'm teaching genetics, to give equal weight to the theory that babies are brought by storks. Babies, I fear, are not brought by storks, and there's no reason at all why I should bring that notion into my science classes. If you wish to discuss the baby stork theory in a theology class or during a rugby match, do it, but don't do it when it's my subject. And that's really what I feel. I think that creationism should not be taught in science classes. If you want to teach it in theology classes, by all means do.
Thank you. Alistair, a brief response to that, both views or not?
I think these questions will naturally arise in science lessons. And I think it's appropriate to be able to say something in response, not to take a religious view, but at least to indicate where this might take you. I think Dr. Rees, or Dr. Rice as his name is, was treated abominably by the Royal Society. I think he got exactly right, and I think that this is not a good day for the Royal Society. I think that that needs to be revisited.
Thank you. Diana.
I think, on the one hand, I'm very in favour of everything being discussed openly and children being educated by open-minded people. But on the other hand, I'm very nervous about what is discussed in which context and how we then label that. So by discussing creationism in a science classroom, it might be because children have questions about creationism, but we might end up, against our own wishes and inclinations, sending the message that we think creationism is a science. And so therefore, somehow, I would want to not shut off a child who raised it, but I would want to find a way to indicate that that is not the appropriate venue in which to discuss it, in my opinion.
Thank you. Simon, a brief word on this.
Very brief. Intelligent design is rubbish in as much as it's not science, and in my view, it's lousy theology. On the other hand, it is known, it has arguments, which I think are unsupportable, but if somebody in a school, in any class, be it the rugby field of biology, says, sir or miss, what is this thing here? Then, of course, you do, to the best of your ability, explain its strengths, because, after all, there are arguments. We are intellectual people, and what I believe is its manifold and total weaknesses. But I would echo very strongly what Alistair said with regard to the sacking of Michael Rice by the Royal Society. I'd be slightly careful because I happen to be an FRS, so that's neither here nor there in this context. But I think it is not only disgraceful, but what is astonishing is the way in which it was organised by a group of people who are fundamentalists. So yes, there they are. These ones happen to be atheist fundamentalists. They're all over the place. And if we're going to have this sort of thing, then one is on an extraordinarily slippery slope. So I think it is appalling.
Thank you. I think actually those will perhaps form our last words. I see that the clock is moving very, very inexorably towards 8 o'clock, and this dais implodes at 8 o'clock if we go on talking here. Before everybody leaves, first of all, remind the audience that there is the possibility of giving to a retiring collection. And also, may I remind you of the bookstall, which is at the back of the cathedral as you exit. It's on the left-hand side. Can I thank all of you for coming? Can I thank those of you who didn't hear anything to begin with for staying? And I hope you have been able to hear and have enjoyed this panel debate. And can I remind you about the debate which takes place here at the same time, same place, next week, 28th of October. Can I remind you also of the Sunday evening services as well, and any more information about the activities of the St Paul's Institute, which you have available and, of course, is all on the Cathedral website. But most of all, may I, on your behalf, thank our speakers, Alistair, Steve, Diana and Simon, for the wonderful learning, insight and humour with which they have led us and responded to our questions this evening. Thank you very much indeed.
That was Seeking Truth, Science, Mystery and Human Identity from St Paul's Cathedral.